Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. How are you doing?
Hey, Dave. It's Tom. How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful.
Excellent. I had a note from Tricia that she and Richard both will not be with us today. Richard is having a procedure. Am I right, Tricia and Richard are not with us, right? Must be right. And Kim, I know
David,
you're here.
Dave,
it's
Kim.
Well.
I'm here.
Welcome. Well,
thank
let's
you.
Do any wins and progress notes. Kim and Tom, what's going on?
I'm just enjoying the reading.
Go ahead.
I've just been enjoying the reading and trying to put down stuff on paper for the class that I want to teach.
Okay, how's that going? What are you finding that's a benefit and applicable for the class?
So if I look at my notes, I think defining the money story, who would be right for the class, are some things that I've sketched out.
And who is your intended audience?
Well, I'm leaving it open to individuals and couples interested in bringing awareness to their money story, or I should say interested in bringing awareness to their beliefs and patterns of behavior that make up their money story, as well as interested in creating a new story. So that's what I'm going to put as of right now, as my attended, you know, who should attend.
And where will you distribute this? Where are you targeting in terms of an awareness?
So I'm first starting at some of my parks and recs that have adult education classes.
Okay.
But I'm also going to reach out to, like, the Rotary Club and some other groups that might have interested members.
Okay. That sounds great. That'll be interesting to see what you find.
Thank you. Yes, I think it's a good start.
Do you have a date?
I think I'm going to pick a date sometime next week. I want to continue having my conversation with the director of Parks and Rec and try to time it with when he puts out his summer brochure so I can hit as many, I could get the information out to as many people as possible. If I could teach it June through July, that might be my timeline, but I'll know more within a week, I think.
I see. That sounds like a good amount of lead time. Well, that sounds great.
Yeah, I think so.
You hear how that unfolds. Kim,
thank
how
you.
Are you doing?
I'm having great fun with everything, I must be honest. The first thing I wanted to ask you, David, did you receive my book yet? Because I sent you one.
I thought I had sent you an email, but I noticed that it got bumped back. Yes, 2 days ago I received it, and I appreciate it very much. It's very elegant and very engaging. I look forward to reading it. I appreciate it.
I look forward to hearing what you think of it.
It looks terrific. Yeah, I'm sorry you didn't get the email. That was one of my next to-dos, is to figure out why you didn't get that.
I'm pleased you eventually got it.
Yeah, absolutely. It looks very attractive. Now, is that a South African publisher, or did you self-publish?
That's a South African publisher. So it was in our bookstores here in South Africa, and it's been very good for my business because my market is people near at or in retirement.
Uh-huh.
And in the book, when you do get a chance to have a look through it, I share my process of how I get people to try and work on what they want for their retirement and then to work out how they can have a better relationship with their money, making sure that it's enabling their retirement instead of holding them back.
That's terrific. I mean, just in looking, it's one of the more attractive books I've seen. It really looks great. So I look forward to looking at it. Yeah, I'll be happy to give you
feedback. That's great. So
feedback.
What I do is with the clients that come to me to plan their financial planning, I use the process in my book to get them thinking. And now with the work that I'm doing with you, I'm looking to enhance it and perhaps work on a different transition, more the transition of reinvention at perhaps the age of 50 into a new career that can take them into their 70s.
Interesting, yeah, okay.
But that's the idea. I mean, I speak a lot on the radio here in South Africa, so I get to speak. I'm on the television here, and I'm busy finalizing my new website with all of this kind of work. So I'm very excited about the journey of learning more.
Well, that's terrific. There have been a couple of people who have applied in a kind of an analogous situation. One person who did training with me in Australia puts the client workbook. There's a lot of background noise. Can you?
Terrible
there,
noise. I hear.
Is there trouble hearing me?
A little bit.
I have no trouble hearing you, but I'm going to. I'll mute myself because
I
think it's me.
Let's see if that's it. Yeah.
There's no background noise now.
So be sure and unmute when you come back, Tom. A guy in South Africa who's an options trader who uses the client workbook for people to be more aware of their money story and to engage in a very different way with him. A woman in New Zealand who does it in money workshops, and a couple of people who use it just as a PDF to work with their clients in groups where they can co-brand the client workbook and have a new first page for their information and that sort of thing. So there are all kind of possibilities to work with it, especially internationally. The digital version, I think, is a useful way to go if you want to use that. But it sounds like you already are incorporating some interesting material, so it will be interesting to see what you think about how you might use this material.
Yes, I'm still trying to work it out, but, I mean, I'm definitely going to be using it. I'm loving it. I'm wanting to come to the States to actually meet you if there is an opportunity for that, even to spend some one-on-one time with you.
I've only mentioned this one time. My wife has encouraged me to take off my headset and get out of my Eames chair and get out in the real world. And I did that this last weekend to do a workshop in Boston. And in fact, I had a chance to meet Tom, which was a real bonus. I'm doing a 3-day retreat in a beautiful setting in the Redwoods in Southern California on your new money story in June.
If that
would happen to work, I know it's you know, quite a few hours from South Africa, especially to California. But I just want to mention that. Just I'll be sending out announcements later. But it's something I look forward to. The group is 1440 Multiversity. It's the same group that started the Omega Institute here, and a number of people: Daniel Goleman, Harville Hendricks, some you know, people who are very savvy in various areas are going to be presenting at different retreats there. So I'm joining a really interesting faculty. But I'll send some information about that in case that's a possibility. But that would be a lot of fun.
That would be. Can you just tell me that options trader that uses your work here in South Africa? Can you put me in contact with him? Because it would be so nice to have somebody else to discuss the work
face-to-face. Andrew
Persolis,
I will send the information to both of you.
Thank you, because then at least we can connect with each other and perhaps even, you know, help each other with the work.
Yeah, that could be very interesting, because he maintains his position as a financial person and just incorporates the other, as it sounds like you're doing too. So that's interesting, yeah.
Thank you, I'd appreciate that.
Sure. Well, what would be helpful for us to talk about? Any work with clients or anything from the reading that you'd like to discuss?
So from my side, I haven't really got any questions. I mean, I'm obviously answering all the questions at this stage for myself, But the process is quite a long process. And for me, when I work with clients, I don't have that much time. So I'm trying to still work out which would be the best ones to do with clients, even if I perhaps did just one section.
Okay. Tom, let me ask you, just for some explicit and honest feedback, was that workshop what you expected, and was it helpful to you working with clients, just in a practical way, things that you can take away and apply?
So, Dave, again, let me apologize for the background noise, but I did hear you say that you met me in Boston at the ICF conference. Did I understand that correctly?
Yes.
You did not meet me.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Thinking about a different setting. Scratch that. My mistake. I have my assistant put a different page in front of me, and I'm reoriented now. Okay.
That's okay.
My mistake. My apologies.
No, that's fine.
So things. Anything that would be helpful to discuss at this point in any realm? If not, I'll move into the material, and then we'll have perhaps more time at the end to discuss.
That sounds
okay. We've discussed the concept of your money story. We've discussed your relationship with money, the first three steps of change, how to recognize, how to own and assess a money story. Now we're going to be looking at step four, basically how to inscribe new code, which is a combination of steps four and five. So let's start with step four, decide what to change in your money story. I'm going to describe a study and have you guess the biggest impact. If you may have heard me present this in a different context, but Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day, the subjects chose a different option from poles of contrasting behavior, like lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive, talk about sports, talk about business. They would choose one of the options and behave according to that for the entire day. Additionally, twice a week, they would eat something they've never eaten before, and twice a week, they would read something they've never read before. So, what do you think the biggest change in this group was? After 4 months, the finding was baffling to them initially. After 4 months, the group lost an average of 11 pounds. And 6 months later, almost everyone had kept the weight off. Many continued to lose. So they were baffled because this wasn't a diet. It was a study focusing on change and its impact. What they found is that when people actually think about their decisions, rather than just habitually choosing a default mode without consideration, they become aware that every behavior is a choice. They become aware that, for example, everything that they ate was a choice. And even every bite was a choice. So they began to ask, is this bite in my best interest? So once becoming actively aware of making choices, you can decide to make the most informed and strategic choices possible. Because in one way of thinking about it, if you want to understand something, try to change it. So let's look a little bit more closely at the idea of choice. We're going to talk about choice architecture and the dynamics of change. Now, despite being presented with ample evidence of how change will be beneficial, many people don't make changes even when they know it's in their own best interest. For example, in studies of coronary bypass patients, when their lives are at risk and they know and get clear information after a massive heart attack in the ICU unless they adopt healthier lifestyles, especially in terms of nutrition and exercise, their life expectancy is very, very limited. Knowing this, knowing the recent scare, how many do you think changed? 1 in 9. Now, remember, your identity is not your behavior or your habits. A habit is not a definition. It's a choice that gets repeated. It's a collection of repetitions. If you define yourself by what you do or by your habits, it will be harder to change. So as soon as someone does that, as a client, I will immediately interrupt and highlight that. If somebody says, well, it's because I'm a procrastinator. Well, that's a collection of choices, but if that choice is made at this moment, it's an active choice and someone has other options. If you define yourself by an identity, it makes it harder to even recognize the option of choice as well as harder to change. Now, remember last seminar, we discussed the equation belief drives behavior, behavior drives performance. So for this step, decide what to change. I want to add an equation. Event plus response equals outcome. Every outcome you experience in life is a result of how you respond to an event in your life. Achievement's an outcome. It's a result of responding in certain ways. It's not what happens to us, but our response to what happens to us that makes the difference. That's what we can determine. So, once more, remember this essential principle for ownership of your money story. In adulthood, you either create or allow everything that happens to you. You worked out, so now you feel more energy and alertness. You didn't attend to marketing, so now your business is slumping. You've spent more than you've earned, so now you have debt. Choice is part of a mindset. The antithesis of choice is also a mindset with its own text. Here's how that sounds. Fate, luck, circumstance, bad traffic, things just happen. I don't think I can do it. The absence of the awareness of choice limits possibility. And a kind of footnote here, I guess. Whatever you're doing that you can't control is your addiction. You can be addicted to a substance, a behavior, such as spending beyond your means, or to a process, such as debt, or a certain kind of relationship, or to compromised results. Money is energy. Anyone addicted to anything has difficulty regulating energy. So I want to consider another, just slightly different perspective, obstacles and desires. So here's another notion to consider. What you seek is camouflaged in what you fear. To say that a little bit of a different way, show me an obstacle and I'll show you a desire, because you create both. For example, show me clutter, I'll show you blocked energy that desires release. We always create the outside to match the inside. In other words, whenever someone presents an obstacle, rather than strategizing to overcome or avoid or defeat it, simply consider not creating it. It's there when you create it. Consider using your energy to generate something else instead. Now, there's an inherent secret here. An obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. It reminds you of what you want, but it makes it seem safe to want if you're afraid of it. Here's an example. I saw a cartoon of a dog straining at its leash, barking fiercely at a cat as if to say, just let me at him. Now, the cat wasn't too shabby. It was as big as the dog and looked really mean. So in the next frame, the dog was barking as ferocious, just let me at him, and the leash snapped. So he was free to go after the cat. He looked back horrified, scared to death, quickly ran back, tied a triple knot, and again strained at his leash, just let me at him. So this is an example of the dialectic of obstacle and desire. Another simple example. You view a scene in a film you don't want to see, so you cover your face with your hand, as if to say, no, I'm not going to look. But then the desire creeps in, and you peek through your fingers at what you're drawn to see. The obstacle makes looking acceptable. So, from a coaching perspective, when you find yourself focusing on an obstacle, for example, I can't find time to exercise, I can't put away any savings, reflect on the underlying desire. And here's the coaching principle. When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. So imagine what it would be like not to create your obstacles. And possibly, when you have a problem or an obstacle, draw it out. Drawing is about relationships, of seeing the whole and seeing the interconnections. As you recreate it yourself, you'll see perhaps relationships, but you'll also see you're in the process of creating it, although in a different way. So let's look at this point in terms of deciding what to change. What neuroscience teaches us about mentor coaching and change? One, and this is all in your outline. People have prior knowledge that affects how they hear and respond to new information. Existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge. It's where learning starts, simply because it can't happen any other way. Remember, we talked before about how whenever you have a belief or a fact or even an attachment or a behavior pattern, it's an anatomical reality in your brain. You have algorithms in your brain that determine responses. We see the evidence. We don't know exactly how they exist, but we see evidence of their existence. We see the resultant behavior. So what we're doing here is looking at how to rewire the brain, how to create new program in the brain. The seven steps of the roadmap is to deconstruct a story, to construct a new one. So we're writing new copy for the brain. Two, what neuroscience teaches us about mentor coaching. That prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent as a neuronal pathway in the brain. One of the challenges of change is that you can't just present a fact or an experience and think it's going to replace or overwrite what's already there, because the fact or the belief is an anatomical structure in the brain. Simply overlaying another fact or belief won't work, because the original structure is still there. So what that means practically is you identify what you want to change, you disrupt the existing pattern, and then create and repeat the new pattern. And probably the most common mistake people make in trying to create change is they just superimpose another pattern on the stuff that's there already without disrupting the existing pattern, like to add a health club membership, or, you know, just to decide to, you know, do something different with a credit card payoff. You have to disrupt the pattern that's there in order to successfully replace it with a new pattern. Three, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. Four, partly because it's complex and personal, and partly because it's subjective reality, which is kind of redundant, I guess, someone is not always aware of their prior knowledge. Remember, 90%+ of our operating system is unconscious. We only see the derivatives, the behaviors, the patterns that are manifest. Five, mentor coaching is about recognizing this process and assessing where changes are necessary. When changes occur in a systematic and consistent way, disrupting the existing pattern, creating new changes, new connections are made in the brain, new maps are created. And six, the mentor-coaching relationship is one of collaborative, contingent conversations. This capacity relies on mirror neurons in which we experience others through our own sensory resonance and ourselves through our own instrument. Mirror neurons and the mirroring capacity allow us to use intuitive perception in mentor coaching. So let's talk about change and the brain. I think this is a significant aspect of deciding what to change and moving into that change. Both our minds and brains automatically resist change. So first, let's look at how the brain opposes change, and then how can we use this information to facilitate success? So obviously, as we've talked before, the brain has a mind of its own, so we need to consider how our brains work. Each of these 10 precepts will help you craft your new money story and help you listen and collaborate with your clients in doing. The mechanisms are a little complex, but the principles are so simple they're almost elusive. So 10 principles of how the brain operates to facilitate change. 1, change generates discomfort. Part of the reason for this resistance to change is due to a fact far more challenging than just getting someone to decide to do things differently. Any attempt to modify behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain. Activities that we've repeated that have become habits are hardwired into the brain. Neuronal pathways and neural nets, the highways and villages in our brain, have become etched by repeated habits to create efficient operation and to make routine behaviors easy. We don't have to think about, for example, how we drive the same way to work each day, because after we've done it for a month or so, the brain creates new neurons and pathways to make it automatic, to minimize the energy that it takes. So because of this default mode, we can think about other things or read a book, an audio book. This default mode is energy efficient and frees up the brain to do other things. Now, when these habits are confronted and have to drive, like when there's construction and you have to snake your way through a neighborhood, it takes energy. You can't really concentrate on a book. The automatic pilots in the midbrain get disrupted. We feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and give attention to the process of thinking things through. It's no longer the default mode. So what this means practically, it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change, to preserve the default habit. Our brains naturally resist change, because this hardwiring of routine behavior saves energy. So the brain opposes what's been adaptive from an evolutionary sense. Now, the promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know that yet, so our minds have to lead the way. Some remarkable new research shows that consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expression. Beliefs turn genes on or turn them off. Ray Kurzweil, in his book, The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology, put this very simply. Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. In other words, how much we can do habitually in a default mode. And we actually see what we expect to see, what our radar has been coded for. In fact, when we don't see what we expect to see, our brain's error detection mechanism reads as if something's wrong. It's located right behind the medial frontal cortex, next to the emotional center of the brain. The brain has this innate capacity to detect what neuroscientists call errors, which is, from the brain's perspective, the difference between expectation and perceived reality. It registers as a sense that something's not quite right. Now, at times, this can be abrupt and explicit. Remember the experience maybe of absentmindedly going to the refrigerator and getting a drink of milk, and then suddenly discover that it was orange juice, and there's this whole immediate disruption of things. This whole error detection mechanism, the disruption of what's expected, is what each of your clients will experience when they try something new, when they move beyond what they have been doing in an automatic and default position to try something new. There's going to be this sense that things aren't right, that there's a difference between expectation and the usual experience. So this is something that we may need to think about reframing with a client so that they don't misread it as, well, this discomfort. My gut is telling me that this is not the right thing, or my intuition is saying this isn't right. When the accurate reading of the experience of discomfort needs to be put in a context of an expectable reaction to change, even at a brain level. So this is what we experience, for example, when there's any kind of challenge or activation of something different. This is why the tragedies and the beating of the knife and gun club lead the news, because this is sensational. This is something different. This is why we rubberneck on the road, because instead of the monotony of driving, boom, there's a wreck, and there's interest. There's an activation of this system, so it creates interest. Now, since this portion of your brain has a job description to recognize and correct errors, consider the emotional impact of a couple of things. One is a lie. The surface story is the constructed lie. The subliminal story is the recognition of the lie by the error detection mechanism. Then you have to deal with the dissonance. Triple work. Another, debt. The real expense of buying something you can't afford is that simply you have to pay more for it. Then the emotional expense of your mind and the dissonance in your brain to recognize that spending is different from affording. Then you have to pay the interest, triple work. So you can deceive others, even your own mind, but your brain always knows. Now, the good news here, this neural machinery can both recognize and correct errors to optimize behavior. So that means we can also respond to mistakes. Now, this is great if we remember to discern whether it's a mistake or simply a neural response and printout to change itself, the kind of natural reaction that we all have with change by experiencing it initially as discomfort. So we'll return to this in a few minutes when we talk about mapping change. Okay, number three for the way the brain operates to facilitate change. The brain is a prediction machine. Do this exercise. I want to tell you some numbers. And if you have a pen, write them down. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, and 8. Consider what's missing. Maybe 3 and 6, multiples of 3. Consider this, nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head, informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd repetition. The stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd rise will follow. A company's increased profits 26 quarters in a row with projected earnings growth to 24 cents for the current quarter. They announce earnings instead of 23 cents, which is still an increase, but it's a penny off the predicted expectation. In the next 5 minutes, they lose $1.5 billion in market value. In those 5 minutes, the intrinsic value of the company, the balance sheet, did not change. The mindset of the investors changed. J. Paul Getty said that there are three key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. So you can see how brain prediction of pattern is also the basis of many jokes, listing two things and then a third non sequitur, setup, setup, payoff. The human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns to make wise and balanced decisions. So we need to be sure that we predict or envision the right things. Four, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO, Chief Operating Officer of a company, determining a policy about employees being on time. Which works better, threats or reinforcements? The answer is neither. Both are likely to backfire. Studies show two things. Threats work short-term, but draw attention away from work and back to the problem that created the behavior. And secondly, recognition for someone being on time actually raises anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns connected with lateness. So in other words, in both instances, the focus is on the negative, either avoiding it or reinforcing the positive over the negative. The focus is still on the negative. Remember, we always get what we focus on, not what we want. So we assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Well, not so, says the brain. In fact, being told what to do results in an innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says avoid change. So in working with a client, this is why in many instances advice really doesn't work as well as we think it does. Because if it's advice that someone can't predict or doesn't know, and it's a total introduction of a new way of thinking about things, there's a natural opposition led by the error detection mechanism that says, well, this isn't what I expected. Five, motivation is not essential. How many times have you heard somebody say, well, you know, I just need to get motivated to lose weight, or I've got to get motivated to work out, or to save money? Well, motivation is not necessary. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. Many of the professional athletes and actors I work with are not motivated to get up and go to the gym every day, yet they do it because they know that in order to do what they need to do next, they have to do that. All they have to do is to have a plan and to stick to it. That's all anyone needs. They do not have to have motivation. If they're waiting for another, if they're putting off doing something by waiting to get motivated, it's just another way of putting it off. If someone is stopping themselves in order to get creative or get motivated, it's just another way of stopping themselves. So the important thing is having a plan and stick to it. Somebody does not have to be motivated to save for their retirement. All they have to do is make one good choice. They make a choice one time to automatically, in perpetuity, deduct X amount of money from their checking account the first of every month and place it in their savings account, in their retirement account. One choice can affect the rest of their lives. They don't have to decide it every month. This is a continuity program. Think about the kind of continuity programs that you're familiar with. You sign up for a subscription to a magazine. They give you the first 3 months free, but, of course, you have to give them the credit card at the beginning. And then as long as you unsubscribe beginning month four, you don't get charged. 82% of people continue with the subscription. 64% of people who continue never read the magazine. It's a continuity program. There's a continuity of the default mode. We have to initiate to do something different, and usually we don't do that. Six, emotions change brain functioning. When emotions are triggered, the brain chemicals, dopamine and adrenaline, are released that prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing knowledge. This is why self-talk is limited. Change your thoughts to change your behavior may work until emotion gets activated. Cortisol, the stress chemical, can actually block information processing. So as soon as emotion is triggered, reason runs and logic leaves. One of the great philosophers of the 21st century put this really simply. Everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. Of course, that was Mike Tyson. When there is a possibility of reward, dopamine is released as an anticipation of that reward to produce an excited state. So this is different that we know now. This is different than it was always assumed, that there was the assumption of you do something that there's an intrinsic reward for, you feel good because dopamine's released as a reward for doing that. What we know now is dopamine is released in anticipation of doing something, in anticipation of spending money, in anticipation of an action that seems in itself rewarding. What I learned to ask back in the years when I was practicing psychiatry and worked for part of my time with and developed an eating disorders treatment program, one of the first couple in the country. And so I worked with many hundreds of young women, a couple of thousand, but many hundreds of young women who were bulimic. And what I learned to ask each one of them is, at what point in the process of eating symptomatically do you notice a state change? 100% of them said, before the food ever touched my mouth. So that there was an awareness at that point that food was only a prop in the process and an unnecessary one at that. But that's the same kind of cycle, the addictive, repetitive cycle that someone can get in, such as with spending money or any one of the various kinds of spending, revenge spending, undisciplined, but whatever it is, it creates its own cycle. And an addiction is a promise that's never kept. You never quite get there. It's never quite enough, so you keep going and try to get the more that is by definition not an end point. So when gamblers were studied, their excitement, their dopamine hit, occurred as they approached the slot machine before they ever touched it. Their increased brain firing and dopamine spike proceeded without ever touching the machine, well before they were ever rewarded with a win. So also, the less predictable a reward is, the longer and stronger the dopamine neurons fire, creating more of a natural high. So remember from college, if a laboratory mouse is given regular predictable rewards every time it hits a lever, then when the food pellet rewards stop, the behavior really stops quickly. But if the food pellets are infrequent and unpredictable, one out of every 75 or 100 or 100 times, the mouse will keep pushing the lever indefinitely, even to the point of exhaustion and death. The behavior is not confined, by the way, to laboratory mice. Watch a bank of slot machines in Vegas, and you'll see the same scenario, complete with lever pulling and reward pellets. The moral: people fall easily into the unconscious pursuit of dopamine and its accompanying pleasure, despite the obviously illogical downside. Also, research shows that the anticipation of reward can actually be more satisfying than receiving it, because attaining the goal actually shuts down the chemical engine of anticipation and the high that goes with it. And when you think about it from a brain standpoint, of course the anticipation is going to feel more pleasurable because it's mediated by dopamine than the result, which means dopamine shut off and there's movement to the long-term system. So you move from the sprint system to the marathon system, and the system mediated by norepinephrine is not as exciting. There's no excitement to that. It's just about sustaining and continuing to focus on the task. So sometimes a client may need help in recognizing that something they've long anticipated, that they were way more excited about in anticipating it than actually doing it, that this is the way their brains work, because this often results, say, in buyer's remorse. Because something you anticipated a long time, really excited about, you get it, and you know, suddenly you're not as excited about it anymore. It just doesn't do the same thing for you. So the way the brain works, and this is also something I've just begun to look at and write about, success anticlimax. People who have sustained an immersion in the pursuit of a success for a long period of time, and a good example of that would be people who train for the Olympics. And I've worked with a number of Olympic athletes. They train for a sustained period of time, and then finally the event or events occur, and then it's like, what do I do now? In fact, Bruce Jenner, after his last event in his last Olympics, said that precisely in that way. He said, well, okay, so what do I do now? The anticipation, even though it's sustained over a long period of time, the anticipation suddenly gives way to the anticlimax of there's nothing to hope for. Robert Louis Stevenson said, let's see, how do you say it? To travel hopefully is better than to arrive. And that's what, that's what our brains believe. 7, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning. The things that excite us and provide a little bit of stress short term can enhance learning and performance. The time window, though, on this phenomenon is up to about 2 hours. For longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, things go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. So that means with sustained stress, people make bad emotionally charged decisions. The most important success strategy, I believe, for us, for our clients, is regulation of states of mind. And, of course, that includes recognizing and managing emotions. But regulation of states of mind, because that determines how we perceive and process everything else. 8, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. The major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place in one position get most entrenched. So a place, for example, that I see this resistance in coaching is family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company he started 36 years ago to his 2 children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone involved changes roles, relationships, and responsibilities. Now, these last 2 principles, I think, are absolutely huge for coaching. 9, neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. 2 things above all others create neurogenesis: an enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment is intellectual and emotional stimulation that creates more complex brain structure to co-create, to stimulate thinking, to challenge, to story bust, exactly the things that we do in mentor coaching. The hippocampus is the part of the brain, the midbrain, especially connected with two things, creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. Exercise increases the number of hippocampal cells by almost 100%. And remember, the hippocampus, the site of creativity and memory. And more recently, non-invasive studies in humans have replicated this in London taxicab drivers and University of Hamburg medical students. Another related finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis, the number of cells in the hippocampus affecting both memory and creativity goes down with chronic stress. And number 10, neuroplasticity simply means that the brain remodels itself. Now, this has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job description can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons. Rezoning, developing new cortical real estate. So when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Here's an example of this. Some NASA astronauts did a training experiment in which they had headgear with a visual apparatus that gave an upside-down image. Everything was exactly reversed. Consistently, 24 hours a day, they were in this headset. So they had to adjust everything. They had to think very carefully for every move they made and think it through because they had to reverse things. Then about day 25, they noticed something remarkable. Their brains automatically made the adjustment. They didn't have to anymore. Their brains had rewired, developed new neural pathways. Now, another group of astronauts in the headgear were given a day off. They were out of the headgear for 24 hours at day 15. When they put the headgear back on, it took them 25 days from that point on to make the adjustment. So notice the role of consistency here. So let's look at step number 5 in the roadmap, map changes. So I want to consider with you just an overview of mapping a new story. A man approached J.P. Morgan, held up an envelope, and said, "Sir, in my hand I hold a guaranteed formula for success, which I'll gladly sell you for $25,000. Now, remember, this was over a century ago. That's when $25,000 was real money. "Sir," J.P. Morgan said, "I do not know what's in the envelope. However, if you show it to me and I like it, I'll give you my word as a gentleman that I'll pay you what you ask." Well, the man agreed to the terms, considering the options, handed over the envelope. J.P. Morgan opened it, extracted a single sheet of paper, gave it one look, handed the piece of paper back to the man, wrote him a check for $25,000. On the page, there were two sentences. "Every morning, write a list of things that need to be done that day. Do them." The human brain creates patterns of connections in our ongoing search for meaning. The brain is a pattern-seeking organ. We seek patterns and we seek to determine the meaning. We seek closure once we see the patterns. These patterns, these mental maps, relate to our ability to plan and predict the future. When our predictions get confirmed repeatedly, these patterns become automatic. They become part of our unconscious algorithms. So we don't even have to think about them. They're hardwired. They're automatic. Lingering unsolved stories in our heads create an emotional drain. Unresolved loops in our heads are part of that emotional drain. So the brain desires to seek closure. One scenario in mentor coaching is when a client is given unfamiliar advice, the uncertainty sets off an error detection mechanism response. This means that somebody can reject the idea before they even consider it, which places another barrier to resist change. So To return for just a moment, this error detection mechanism explains a number of dynamic factors. We notice differences more easily than confirmations, so it's easier to focus on the things we do wrong and maybe at the same time struggle to list our strengths. We focus on problems, which energizes because it activates the error detection mechanism. So problems are both familiar and energizing. It's way easier to focus on problems. That's the most common addiction that we have as people, to focus on problems. Bad news gets our attention for the same reason. And as I mentioned, a road accident causes people to stop and stare at the unexpected that commands our attention. The automatic patterns and related belief systems, the very mechanisms that allow fluid function in the world, are all examples of mental maps. Mental maps become our unconscious operating manual. So we listen in our clients for the mental maps that are booted up by a particular stimulus, and we listen for if the mental map is appropriate for the situation, if it's current, instead of being a software program that was written at an earlier time when the situation has evolved or possibilities have evolved. So the mental maps that were tailor-made for a certain context in our lives, such as stress or in childhood, may not apply in another situation. So this is where the mentor coaching process highlights the recognition, ownership, and assessment of those storylines in order to map new changes. The hardwiring is not permanent. Mentor coaching is a way of rewiring the brain and revising mind software. So, to map change, I believe there are six crucial elements, and I want to talk about how to understand and incorporate each of the six. This is an outline to master a money story. One is regulation of states of mind. We've already covered that. We've talked about how people make decisions emotionally, justify them logically, how market bubbles occur. For example, Dr. Vernon Smith won a Nobel Prize in economics by demonstrating how market bubbles are created. He did a series of trading experiments with economic graduate students. They were informed the fair value of a security as $3. So these traders knew the actual worth of a security, a significant advantage over the normal Wall Street trader situation. So what happened in price bidding? They still ran the price up significantly past the $3 mark. And when they stopped paying a premium, the market crashed. In the second experiment, the same group formed another smaller bubble. In the first round, it was in the high fives. The second, it was in the mid $4 range. It wasn't until the third round that people stuck to the actual value. Dr. Smith repeated this experiment with even more seasoned people, finance professors and other economic specialists. They formed the same kind of bubbles. The first round, they went into the $4.30 range on average. The second round, the $3.60 range. It wasn't until their third round that they stuck to the actual value of the security. It was the equivalent of the child who said, well, you know, the emperor doesn't really have any clothes on. This seemingly irrational force that overrides logic and knowledge and causes us to believe that rising prices will continue to rise indefinitely, or at least as long as we're betting on them, is simply human behavior. And remember, as we talked, states of mind are like software programs. They're a mind-body state that determines how we perceive and then how we process information and respond. And we each have a different number of states of mind: relaxation, alertness, anxiety, anger, centered attention, confidence. A key element is to be aware of our different states of mind and know which state works best for what purpose. For example, creative writing and editing, two different parts of the brain. So two different time periods brainstorming versus completing a project. When someone's in an emotional state, they're overbalanced toward right brain response, the feeling brain. In extreme stress, the emotional brain hijacks the intellectual, logical brain and holds it hostage. And we're going to be talking about this a good deal more in Seminar 6 when we devote that entire seminar and one entire module to states of mind. The number two element to map changes. The power is in focus. This is the neuroscience and quantum mechanics behind the law of attraction. Most of you are probably very familiar with that. In fact, there's a white paper in my articles section on my website that's about the neuroscience of the law of attraction. Thoughts have a frequency and energy field. Focus selects that frequency. It's kind of analogous to saying all the channels of a radio or satellite TV are available. We choose the channel, the frequency we want, out of hundreds of possibilities. We each transmit and receive a frequency through our thoughts. So if you want to change something in your life, change the frequency, the channel. Change your thoughts. Now, the bad news, if you think about what you don't want, it keeps showing up over and over. Now, according to quantum physics, we each generate energy frequencies or vibrations. We project energy in our emotions and thoughts that are the source of what and who we attract, as well as the basis of our sense of well-being. The quantum Zeno effect, Z-E-N-O, says, the mental act of attention activates and holds in place brain circuitry. With consistent focus and repetition, these chemical links actually become stable changes in the brain structure. The brain rewires. Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz at UCLA, a neuroscientist, has done most research and coined this term, the quantum Zeno effect. He was a guest not too long ago as an expert content contributor in my mastermind group. Quantum physics offers us still another paradigm. In addition to our individual energy field, there's a collective field. Einstein called this the unified field theory. Basically, the human mind and body are bundles of energy and interact with the energy field of another person, and that interaction can be synchronistic, and there can be a resonance there. We also interact with another group as a whole, so that that energy field also has a mutual and reciprocal effect, which is one reason, for example, in my view, why let's look at a study that is standardized, that has all the trappings of a scientific study. It's a controlled study. In the NBA, you play half of your 82 games away. You play half at home. On the road, you lose twice as many on average as you do at home. Negative energy field away, positive energy field at home. I did a demo in the workshop I was doing Friday with the New England ICF group. Asked for a volunteer and asked for her to extend her left arm parallel with the floor, and I stood just slightly behind her. I asked the group, I did a test. I said, resist me pushing this down. And with some effort, with my left hand and arm, I could push her left hand and arm down. Now, I asked the group to send her positive energy, to be totally positive and channel that to her. Ask her to resist again, and I could not push it down with my left hand and arm. Ask them to do one more thing, to just briefly send her negative energy, negative thoughts, negative energy. I could push her arm down with one finger. So it makes a difference. States of mind are contagious, midbrain to midbrain. So we project energy frequencies and, like a magnet, attract what we focus on. If we focus on the negative and on problems, that'll be what we create. If we focus on the positive and on solutions, that'll be what we create. So this is how we can read people, focus our choices, determine the flow of what we do. This concept offers explanation at a brain level for why a solution focus is way more effective than a problem focus. The brain connections literally become mind maps and subsequently influence the reality that we see. When we look at a possibility, we activate new areas, new connections, and new neuronal networks in the brain. When we look at a problem, we re-enter what's already there and actually etch it further. So the paradox is we don't attract what we want, we attract what we focus on. Everybody wants more money, so wanting isn't the key to having it. Focusing on scarcity attracts scarcity. Focusing on prosperity aligns energy to pursue prosperity. Now, your unconscious doesn't register positive or negative, just the focus. You know, it's much like in the old style camera, a print or negative is the same image. Your unconscious is that image. The power is the focus. What you attend to or focus on, you align yourself to create. So be sure you focus on the right thing. Here are some bad examples. I want to get out of debt. The focus is negative. It's on debt. I want to lose weight. Well, the focus is on overweight. Joseph Murray, Dr. Joseph Murray, puts this very simply. Your subconscious mind does not argue with you. It accepts what your conscious mind decrees. If you say, I can't afford it, your subconscious mind works to make it true. 3, visualize changes. When we actually visualize something, we create the same changes in our brain as when we actually see it when it comes to the optic nerve. The same firing occurs with visualization as with actually doing something or seeing something. Here's an example of a prototype study that initiated some of this work. Basketball players at Ohio State University were divided into 3 groups to practice shooting free throws. One group, no practice for a month. Another group, 30 minutes of practice at free throws every day for 30 days. And the third group, they practiced imagining shooting free throws for at least 5 minutes a day for 30 days. Now, they were tested at the end of 30 days. First group, no practice, 0% improvement. Second group, actual practice for 30 minutes daily, 24% improvement. The third group, practice by visualization only, 23% improvement. Subsequently, these studies have shown how visualization actually is more effective because you don't have to spend the time with like near misses and then corrections and that sort of thing. You can do nothing but net every time. So one possibility for somebody who's really afraid of doing something, create a vision. Then look back and see the path to get there. The most common mistake is having a vague sketch rather than a vision. So a visualization crystallizes possibility into an articulated idea. The experience changes the brain. So the vision serves as guide and inspiration to design ways to realize it, to live into it. I'm going to send each of you a copy of a book that I've done that has a chapter in it on the old art and the new science of visualization. It's about a scientific way to structure a visualization to rewire the brain and a way to structure a systematic approach to affirmations, which are the story that support the visualization, which are ways simply to revise mind software. And that book, I'm going to see, it's an e-book, and I'm doing a revision and update. As soon as I get that done, I will send you a copy. Number 4, insight changes the brain. And we've talked before, a moment of insight, 3 different parts of the brain light up, and someone is vaulted to a state of mind that is more synthetic, integrative, and creative. Consider, instead of the moment of insight, the aha moment, what happens when someone is given a fact, information, a direction, nothing happens. Nothing lights up. So as important as insight-induced change is, the sustained attention is what hardwires it in the brain circuit. 5, take action. The world will not pay you for what you know. It'll pay you for what you do. It rewards action. To analyze and plan are important. Payday comes with action. Winners develop a plan and set it into motion. It may not be perfect, but you can self-correct, keep moving forward, learn from mistakes, and produce results. This is why maybe a group of the brightest people anywhere with all kinds of degrees can plan and figure out something, but struggle to make it happen. And meanwhile, the guy who almost finished the second semester of the first year in community college has a bunch of real estate on the west side of town. And finally, 6, transform identity. This is the P of the roadmap. We're going to spend important time talking about this when we get to that part of the roadmap in session number 5. So a new experience or idea has to be focused on consistently and frequently. When attention is consistent, brain circuitry is stabilized. The mindset of identity then incorporates this new experience to integrate it as part of an evolving self, as a component of one's identity, as a true self. Otherwise, as I mentioned, that one of the most powerful forces of the psyche is to return to our core identity. Unless we change that identity, it'll just be a piece of behavior that we did, and it'll be lost. So this step 7, program new identity, is what we're going to return to and look at in terms of systematically incorporating that. So now, in summary, some specific aspects to help clients change behavior, minds, and brains. Begin where the client is. Help them learn more about what they already know. Highlight positive attributes, existing neuronal networks like natural talents or behaviors or patterns to encourage their practice. Don't focus on mistakes. Focus will only enhance neuronal etching, so it should be on useful habits. Correct mistaken couplings. Understand and build on existing networks. Let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lay. Encourage the clients to develop their own metaphors and connections. Stories, analogies, metaphors all create maps. The brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel connections. You have to recognize and take ownership of your experience, first 2 steps. When you write a new story, change your minds, we change our brains as well. So give attention to a new experience or a new way of doing things consistently and repetitively. Well, I got actually involved with some of the stories and the illustrations and took up way more time than I had planned. I had planned to have much more discussion. So any thoughts or questions about anything that we talked about? Or anything you want to highlight maybe for discussion later? Or any clarifications of anything that I've talked about to start with? Anything?
Nothing on my end, Dave.
Okay.
Now, I think what I found very interesting is how we do focus on the negative, and that's why we end up not achieving what we necessarily want to achieve. You know, the times before when we failed, your brain automatically wants to remember those.
That's what makes problems so much of an addiction, because we've got that down. We know what to do. We know the stories of the problems, and we tend to go back and reiterate the stories of the problems because that's the familiar, plus doing something new and different. It's a challenge because we don't know that it's going to be successful. We don't have that pathway yet down, so it's going to be uncertainty, anxiety, trepidation, doing something that's new. It's going to take more energy. So there are some things that have to be addressed in order to have a plan and stick to it. And that's exactly where we come in as coaches. That's part of the very essence of how we earn our money, to help someone navigate these changes and transitions and transformations to get to where they want to go. Well,
I think for me...
Go ahead.
No, I was saying that I think for me, I find it easy to help clients navigate when it's around their money. But because I've always had a mental block around weight, I kind of relate a lot of the work that I'm doing to your readings to that conversation of saying, I want to lose weight.
Uh-huh.
And my husband always does it to me. He says, I'm eating a little bit of food, I'm eating healthy food, and he never, ever puts on any weight. Whereas I will always say, oh, this is so unhealthy, I can't believe I'm eating this. And I'm telling my brain it all the time.
Well, that may be something, I know your focus with your clients is on money. That may be something that you want to do a roadmap case study for yourself, at least, or to present to us, or at least for yourself, to really see if using those seven steps to deconstruct a story and to construct or revise one in exactly the way you want, if that can be of help to you. Because exactly those seven steps are about writing new program.
Mm-hmm.
In this group, there were like 70, 75 people. I asked, as we began to look at the row, I said, how many of you can write program for your computer? One person raised her hand. And I said, how many of you would like to write new program for your brain? And almost every hand went up, and I said, that's exactly what we're going to do. And this is what the roadmap system does. So look at it and see if you think it might be helpful in this regard. And you can just check for yourself, or if you want to share with us, we'll be eager to hear.
I'm very interested, and I'm looking forward to that ebook you're going to send us.
Okay, yeah. Outsmart Your Brain, an Instruction Manual. Okay? All right. Well, thanks very much. Have a great week, and look forward to picking up with you right here next time. Bye.
Thanks, Dave.
Great.
You too.
Thank
bye-bye.
You very much.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.